I don't understand any of it. Respectable people don't go to jail. Do something. You've always known what to do about business.
Not this kind of business.
I don't believe it. Her voice had the tone of a frightened, spoiled child.
You're saying it just to be mean.
He's playing the hero, Mother, said Lillian. She smiled coldly, turning to Reardon. Don't you think that your attitude is perfectly futile?
No.
You know that cases of this kind are not intended ever to come to trial. There are ways to avoid it, to get things settled amicably, if one knows the right people.
I don't know the right people.
Look at Aaron Boyle. He's done much more and much worse than your little fling at the black market, but he's smart enough to keep himself out of courtrooms.
Then I'm not smart enough.
Don't you think it's time you made an effort to adjust yourself to the conditions of our age?
No.
Well, then I don't see how you can pretend that you're some sort of victim. If you go to jail, it will be your own fault.
What pretense are you talking about, Lillian?
Oh, I know that you think you're fighting for some sort of principle. But actually, it's only a matter of your incredible conceit. You're doing it for no better reason than because you think you're right.
Do you think they're right?
She shrugged. That's the conceit I'm talking about. The idea that it matters who's right or wrong. It's the most insufferable form of vanity. This insistence on always doing right. How do you know what's right? How can anyone ever know it? It's nothing but a delusion to flatter your own ego and to hurt other people by flaunting your superiority over them. He was looking at her with attentive interest.
Why should it hurt other people, if it's nothing but a delusion?
Is it necessary for me to point out that in your case, it's nothing but hypocrisy? That is why I find your attitude preposterous. Questions of right have no bearing on human existence. And you're certainly nothing but human, aren't you, Henry? You're no better than any of the men you're going to face tomorrow. I think you should remember that it's not for you to make a stand on any sort of principle. Maybe you're a victim in this particular mess. Maybe they're pulling a rotten trick on you, but what of it? They're doing it because they're weak. They couldn't resist the temptation to grab your metal and to muscle in on your profits, because they had no other way of ever getting rich. Why should you blame them? It's only a question of different strains, but it's the same shoddy human fabric that gives way just as quickly. You wouldn't be tempted by money because it's so easy for you to make it, but you wouldn't withstand other pressures, and you'd fall just as ignominiously, wouldn't you? So you have no right to any righteous indignation against them. You have no moral superiority to assert or to defend. And if you haven't, then what is the point of fighting a battle that you can't win? I suppose that one might find some satisfaction in being a martyr if one is above reproach, but you, who are you to cast the first stone? She paused to observe the effect. There was none, except that his look of attentive interest seemed intensified. He listened as if he were held by some impersonal scientific curiosity. It was not the response she had expected. I believe you understand me, she said.
No, he answered quietly.
I don't. I think you should abandon the illusion of your own perfection, which you know full well to be an illusion. I think you should learn to get along with other people. The day of the hero is past. This is the day of humanity, in a much deeper sense than you imagine. Human beings are no longer expected to be saints, nor to be punished for their sins. Nobody is right or wrong. We're all in it together. We're all human, and the human is the imperfect. You'll gain nothing tomorrow by proving that they're wrong. You ought to give in with good grace, simply because it's the practical thing to do. You ought to keep silent precisely because they're wrong. They'll appreciate it. Make concessions for others, and they'll make concessions for you. Live and let live, give and take, give in and take in. That's the policy of our age, and it's time you accepted it. Don't tell me that you're too good for it. You know that you're not. You know that I know it. The look of his eyes, held raptly still upon some point in space, was not an answer to her words. It was an answer to a man's voice saying to him, Do you think that what you're facing is merely a conspiracy to seize your wealth? You, who know the source of wealth, should know it's much more and much worse than that. He turned to look at Lillian. He was seeing the full extent of her failure, in the immensity of his own indifference. The droning stream of her insults was like the sound of a distant riveting machine, a long impotent pressure that reached nothing within him. He had heard her studied reminders of his guilt on every evening he had spent at home in the past 3 months, but guilt had been the one emotion he had found himself unable to feel. The punishment she had wanted to inflict on him was the torture of shame. What she had inflicted was the torture of boredom. He remembered his brief glimpse on that morning in the Wayne Falkland Hotel of a flaw in her scheme of punishment, which he had not examined. Now he stated it to himself for the first time. She wanted to force upon him the suffering of dishonor, but his own sense of honor was her only weapon of enforcement. She wanted to wrest from him an acknowledgment of his moral depravity, but only his own moral rectitude could attach significance to such a verdict. She wanted to injure him by her contempt, but he could not be injured unless he respected her judgment. She wanted to punish him for the pain he had caused her, and she held her pain as a gun aimed at him, as if she wished to extort his agony at the point of his pity. But her only tool was his own benevolence, his concern for her, his compassion. Her only power was the power of his own virtues. What if he chose to withdraw it? An issue of guilt, he thought, had to rest on his own acceptance of the code of justice that pronounced him guilty. He did not accept it. He never had. His virtues, all the virtues she needed to achieve his punishment, came from another code and lived by another standard. He felt no guilt, no shame, no regret, no dishonor. He felt no concern for any verdict she chose to pass upon him. He had lost respect for her judgment long ago. And the sole chain still holding him was only a last remnant of pity. But what was the code on which she acted? What sort of code permitted the concept of a punishment that required the victim's own virtue as the fuel to make it work? A code, he thought, which would destroy only those who tried to observe it. A punishment from which only the honest would suffer, while the dishonest would escape unhurt. Could one conceive of an infamy lower than to equate virtue with pain? To make virtue, not vice, the source and motive power of suffering? If he were the kind of rotter she was struggling to make him believe he was, then no issue of his honor and his moral worth would matter to him. If he wasn't, then what was the nature of her attempt? To count upon his virtue and use it as an instrument of torture, to practice blackmail with the victim's generosity as sole means of extortion, to accept the gift of a man's goodwill and turn it into a tool for the giver's destruction. He sat very still, contemplating the formula of so monstrous an evil that he was able to name it, but not to believe it possible. He sat very still, held by the hammering of a single question. Did Lillian know the exact nature of her scheme? Was it a conscious policy devised with full awareness of its meaning? He shuddered. He did not hate her enough to believe it. He looked at her. She was absorbed at the moment in the task of cutting a plum pudding that stood as a mount of blue flame on a silver platter before her, its glow dancing over her face and her laughing mouth. She was plunging a silver knife into the flame with a practiced, graceful curve of her arm. She had metallic leaves in the red, gold, and brown colors of autumn scattered over one shoulder of her black velvet gown. They glittered in the candlelight. He could not get rid of the impression, which he had kept receiving and rejecting for 3 months, that her vengeance was not a form of despair, as he had supposed, the impression which he regarded as inconceivable, that she was enjoying it. He could find no trace of pain in her manner. She had an air of confidence new to her. She seemed to be at home in her house for the first time. Even though everything within the house was of her own choice and taste, she had always seemed to act as the bright, efficient, resentful manager of a high-class hotel, who keeps smiling in bitter amusement at her position of inferiority to the owners. The amusement remained, but the bitterness was gone. She had not gained weight, but her features had lost their delicate sharpness in a blurring, softening look of satisfaction. Even her voice sounded as if it had grown plump. He did not hear what she was saying. She was laughing in the last flicker of the blue flames while he sat weighing the question. Did she know? He felt certain that he had discovered a secret much greater than the problem of his marriage, that he had grasped the formula of a policy practiced more widely throughout the world than he dared to contemplate at the moment. But to convict a human being of that practice was a verdict of irrevocable damnation, and he knew that he would not believe it of anyone so long as the possibility of a doubt remained. No, he thought, looking at Lillian with the last effort of his generosity, he would not believe it of her. In the name of whatever grace and pride she possessed, in the name of such moments when he had seen a smile of joy on her face, the smile of a living being, in the name of the brief shadow of love he had once felt for her, he would not pronounce upon her a verdict of total evil. The butler slipped a plate of plum pudding in front of him, and he heard Lillian's voice. Where have you been for the last 5 minutes, Henry? Or is it for the last century? You haven't answered me. You haven't heard a word I said. I heard it, he answered quietly. I don't know what you're trying to accomplish. What a question, said his mother. Isn't that just like a man? She's trying to save you from going to jail. That's what she's trying to accomplish. That could be true, he thought. Perhaps, by the reasoning of some crude, childish cowardice, the motive of their malice was a desire to protect him, to break him down into the safety of a compromise. It's possible, he thought, but knew that he did not believe it. You've always been unpopular, said Lillian, and it's more than a matter of any one particular issue. It's that unyielding, intractable attitude of yours. The men who are going to try you know what you're thinking. That's why they'll crack down on you, while they'd let another man off. Why, no. I don't know they know what I'm thinking. That's what I have to let them know tomorrow. Unless you show them that you're willing to give in and cooperate, you won't have a chance. You've been too hard to deal with. No, I've been too easy. But if they put you in jail, said his mother, what's going to happen to your family? Have you thought of that? No, I haven't. Have you thought of the disgrace you'll bring upon us? Mother, do you understand the issue in this case? No, I don't, and I don't want to understand. It's all dirty business and dirty politics. All business is just dirty politics, and all politics is just dirty business. I never did want to understand any of it. I don't care who's right or wrong, but what I think a man ought to think of first is his family. Don't you know what this will do to us? No, Mother, I don't know or care. His mother looked at him aghast. Well, I think you have a very provincial attitude, all of you, said Philip suddenly. Nobody here seems to be concerned with the wider social aspects of the case. I don't agree with you, Lillian. I don't see why you say that they're pulling some sort of rotten trick on Henry and that he's in the right. I think he's guilty as hell. Mother, I can explain the issue to you very simply. There's nothing unusual about it. The courts are full of cases of this kind. Businessmen are taking advantage of the national emergency in order to make money. They break the regulations which protect the common welfare of all, for the sake of their own personal gain. They're profiteers of the black market, who grow rich by defrauding the poor of their rightful share at a time of desperate shortage. They pursue a ruthless, grasping, grabbing antisocial policy based on nothing but plain selfish greed. It's no use pretending about it. We all know it, and I think it's contemptible. He spoke in a careless, offhand manner, as if explaining the obvious to a group of adolescents. His tone conveyed the assurance of a man who knows that the moral ground of his stand is not open to question. Reardon sat looking at him, as if studying an object seen for the first time. Somewhere deep in Reardon's mind, as a steady, gentle, inexorable beat, was a man's voice saying, "By what right? By what code? By what standard?" "Philip," he said, not raising his voice. "Say any of that again, and you will find yourself out in the street right now with the suit you've got on your back, with whatever change you've got in your pocket, and with nothing else." He heard no answer, no sound, no movement. He noted that the stillness of the three before him had no element of astonishment. The look of shock on their faces was not the shock of people at a sudden explosion of a bomb, but the shock of people who had known that they were playing with a lighted fuse. There were no outcries, no protests, no questions. They knew that he meant it, and they knew everything it meant. A dim, sickening feeling told him that they had known it long before he did. You wouldn't throw your own brother out on the street, would you? His mother said at last. It was not a demand, but a plea. I would. But he's your brother. Doesn't that mean anything to you?
No.
Maybe he goes a bit too far at times, but it's just loose talk. It's just that modern jabber. He doesn't know what he's saying.
Then let him learn.
Don't be hard on him. He's younger than you and weaker. Henry, don't look at me that way. I've never seen you look like that. You shouldn't frighten him. You know that he needs you.
Does he know it?
You can't be hard on a man who needs you. It will prey on your conscience for the rest of your life.
It won't.
You've got to be kind, Henry.
I'm not.
You've got to have some pity.
I haven't.
A good man knows how to forgive.
I don't.
You wouldn't want me to think that you're selfish?
I am.
This morning Reardon had gone to his office, as usual, even though the rest of the office building was closed. At lunchtime he had stopped at the rolling mills and had been astonished to find the wet nurse standing there, alone in a corner, ignored by everybody, watching the work with an air of childish enjoyment.
"What are you doing here today?" Reardon had asked.
"Don't you know it's a holiday?" "Oh, I let the girls off, but I just came in to finish some business."
"What business?"
"Oh, letters and—" "Oh, hell, I signed 3 letters and sharpened my pencils. I know I didn't have to do it today, but I had nothing to do at home, and I get lonesome away from this place."
"Don't you have any family?"
"No, not to speak of." "What about you, Mr. Reardon? Don't you have any?"
"I guess. Not to speak of."
"I like this place. I like to hang around. You know, Mr. Reardon, what I studied to be was a metallurgist."
Walking away, Reardon had turned to glance back and had caught the wet nurse looking after him as a boy would look at the hero of his childhood's favorite adventure story.
God help the poor little bastard, he had thought.
God help them all, he thought, driving through the dark streets of a small town, borrowing, in contemptuous pity, the words of their belief, which he had never shared.
He saw newspapers displayed on metal stands, with the black letters of headlines screaming to empty corners, "Railroad disaster." He had heard the news on the radio that afternoon. There had been a wreck on the main line of Taggart Transcontinental near Rockland, Wyoming. A split rail had sent a freight train crashing over the edge of a canyon. Wrecks on the Taggart main line were becoming more frequent. The track was wearing out, the track which, less than 18 months ago, Dagny was planning to rebuild, promising him a journey from coast to coast on his own mettle. She had spent a year picking worn rail from abandoned branches to patch the rail of the main line. She had spent months fighting the men of Jim's board of directors, who said that the national emergency was only temporary, and a track that had lasted for 10 years could well last for another winter until spring, when conditions would improve, as Mr. Wesley Mooch had promised. 3 weeks ago she had made them authorize the purchase of 60,000 tons of new rail. It could do no more than make a few patches across the continent in the worst divisions. But it was all she had been able to obtain from them. She had had to wrench the money out of men deaf with panic. The freight revenues were falling at such a rate that the men of the board had begun to tremble, staring at Jim's idea of the most prosperous year in Taggart history. She had had to order steel rail. There was no hope of obtaining an emergency need permission to buy Reardon metal, and no time to beg for it. Reardon looked away from the headlines to the glow at the edge of the sky, which was the city of New York far ahead. His hands tightened on the wheel a little. It was 9:30 when he reached the city. Dagny's apartment was dark when he let himself in with his key. He picked up the telephone and called her office. Her own voice answered.
"Taggart Transcontinental."
"Don't you know it's a holiday?" he asked.
"Hello, Hank." "Railroads have no holidays. Where are you calling from?"
"Your place."
"I'll be through in another 30 minutes.
"It's all right, stay there. I'll come for you."
The anteroom of her office was dark when he entered, except for the lighted glass cubbyhole of Eddie Willer's. Eddie was closing his desk, getting ready to leave. He looked at Reardon in puzzled astonishment.
Good evening, Eddie. What is it that keeps you people so busy? The Rockland wreck? Eddie sighed.
Yes, Mr. Reardon.
That's what I want to see Dagny about. About your rail.
She's still here.
He started toward her door, when Eddie called after him hesitantly. Mr. Reardon?
He stopped. Yes?
I wanted to say, because tomorrow is your trial, and whatever they do to you is supposed to be in the name of all the people, I just wanted to say that that it won't be in my name, even if there's nothing I can do about it except to tell you. Even if I know that that doesn't mean anything.
It means much more than you suspect. Perhaps more than any of us suspect. Thanks, Eddie.
Dagny glanced up from her desk when Reardon entered her office. He saw her watching him as he approached, and he saw the look of weariness disappearing from her eyes. He sat down on the edge of the desk. She leaned back, brushing a strand of hair off her face, her shoulders relaxing under her thin white blouse.
Dagny, there's something I want to tell you about the rail that you ordered. I want you to know this tonight.
She was watching him attentively. The expression of his face pulled hers into the same look of quietly solemn tension.
I'm supposed to deliver to Tagger Transcontinental on February 15th. 60,000 tons of rail, which is to give you 300 miles of track. You will receive for the same sum of money 80,000 tons of rail, which will give you 500 miles of track. You know what material is cheaper and lighter than steel? Your rail will not be steel. It will be Reardon metal. Don't argue, object, or agree. I'm not asking for your consent. You are not supposed to consent or to know anything about it. I am doing this, and I alone will be responsible. We will work it out so that those on your staff who will know that you've ordered steel won't know that you've received Reardon metal, and those who will know that you've received Reardon metal won't know that you had no permit to buy it. We will tangle the bookkeeping in such a way that if the thing should ever blow up, nobody will be able to pin anything on anybody except on me. They might suspect that I bribed someone on your staff, or they might suspect that you were in on it, but they won't be able to prove it. I want you to give me your word that you will never admit it, no matter what happens. It's my metal, and if there are any chances to take, it's I who will take them. I have been planning this from the day I received your order. I've ordered the copper for it from a source which will not betray me. I did not intend to tell you about it till later, but I changed my mind. I want you to know it tonight, because I'm going on trial tomorrow for the same kind of crime.
She had listened without moving. At his last sentence, he saw a faint contraction of her cheeks and lips. It was not quite a smile, but it gave him her whole answer. Pain, admiration, understanding. Then he saw her eyes becoming softer, more painfully, dangerously alive. He took a wrist as if the tight grasp of his fingers and the severity of his glance were to give her the support she needed, and he said sternly, "Don't thank me. This is not a favor. I'm doing it in order to be able to bear my work, or else I'll break like Ken Daneker." She whispered, "All right, Hank, I won't thank you." The tone of her voice and the look of her eyes making it a lie by the time it was uttered. He smiled. "Give me the word I asked." She inclined her head. "I give you my word." He released her wrist. She added, not raising her head, "The only thing I'll say is that if they sentence you to jail tomorrow, I'll quit, without waiting for any destroyer to prompt me."
"You won't." "And I don't think they'll sentence me to jail. I think they'll let me off very lightly. I have a hypothesis about it. I'll explain it to you afterwards when I put it to the test."
"What hypothesis?"
"Who is John Galt?"
He smiled and stood up.
"That's all. We won't talk any further about my trial tonight. You don't happen to have anything to drink in your office, have you?"
"No, but I think my traffic manager has some sort of a bar on one shelf of his filing closet."
"Do you think you could steal a drink for me if he doesn't have it locked?"
"I'll try."
He stood looking at the portrait of Nat Taggart on the wall of her office, the portrait of a young man with a lifted head, until she returned bringing a bottle of brandy and two glasses. He filled the glasses in silence.
You know Dagny? Thanksgiving was a holiday established by productive people to celebrate the success of their work. The movement of his arm as he raised his glass went from the portrait to her, to himself, to the buildings of the city beyond the window. For a month in advance, the people who filled the courtroom had been told by the press that they would see the man who was a greedy enemy of society. But they had come to see the man who had invented Reardon metal. He stood up when the judges called upon him to do so. He wore a gray suit, he had pale blue eyes and blonde hair. It was not the colors that made his figure seem icily implacable. It was the fact that the suit had an expensive simplicity seldom flaunted these days, that it belonged in the sternly luxurious office of a rich corporation, that his bearing came from a civilized era and clashed with the place around him. The crowd knew from the newspapers that he represented the evil of ruthless wealth, and, as they praised the virtue of chastity, then ran to see any movie that displayed a half-naked female on its posters, so they came to see him. Evil, at least, did not have the stale hopelessness of a bromide which none believed and none dared to challenge. They looked at him without admiration. Admiration was a feeling they had lost the capacity to experience long ago. They looked with curiosity, and a dim sense of defiance against those who had told them that it was their duty to hate him. A few years ago they would have jeered at his air of self-confident wealth. But today there was a slate-gray sky in the windows of the courtroom, which promised the first snowstorm of a long, hard winter. The last of the country's oil was vanishing, and the coal mines were not able to keep up with the hysterical scramble for winter supplies. The crowd in the courtroom remembered that this was the case which had cost them the services of Ken Daniger. There were rumors that the output of the Daniger Coal Company had fallen perceptibly within 1 month. The newspapers said that it was merely a matter of readjustment while Daniger's cousin was reorganizing the company he had taken over. Last week, the front pages had carried the story of a catastrophe on the site of a housing project under construction. Defective steel girders had collapsed, killing 4 workmen. The newspapers had not mentioned, but the crowd knew, that the girders had come from Orrin Boyle's Associated Steel. They sat in the courtroom in heavy silence, and they looked at the tall, gray figure, not with hope, they were losing the capacity to hope, but with an impassive neutrality, spiked by a faint question mark. The question mark was placed over all the pious slogans they had heard for years. The newspapers had snarled that the cause of the country's troubles, as this case demonstrated, was the selfish greed of rich industrialists, that it was men like Hank Reardon who were to blame for the shrinking diet, the falling temperature, and the cracking roofs in the homes of the nation, that if it had not been for men who broke regulations and hampered the government's plans, prosperity would have been achieved long ago, and that a man like Hank Reardon was prompted by nothing but the profit motive. This last was stated without explanation or elaboration, as if the words profit motive were the self-evident brand of ultimate evil. The crowd remembered that the same newspapers less than 2 years ago had screamed that the production of Reardon metal should be forbidden, because its producer was endangering people's lives for the sake of his greed. They remembered that the man in gray had ridden in the cab of the first engine to run over a track of his own metal, and that he was now on trial for the greedy crime of withholding from the public a load of the metal which it had been his greedy crime to offer in the public market. According to the procedure established by directives, cases of this kind were not tried by a jury, but by a panel of 3 judges appointed by the Bureau of Economic Planning and National Resources. The procedure, the directives had stated, was to be informal and democratic. The judge's bench had been removed from the old Philadelphia courtroom for this occasion and replaced by a table on a wooden platform. It gave the room an atmosphere suggesting the kind of meeting where a presiding body puts something over on a mentally retarded membership. One of the judges, acting as prosecutor, had read the charges.
"You may now offer whatever plea you wish to make in your own defense," he announced.
Facing the platform, his voice inflectionless and peculiarly clear, Hank Reardon answered,
"I have no defense."
"Do you?"
The judge stumbled. He had not expected it to be that easy.
Do you throw yourself upon the mercy of this court?
I do not recognize this court's right to try me.
What?
I do not recognize this court's right to try me.
But, Mr. Reardon, this is the legally appointed court to try this particular category of crime.
I do not recognize my action as a crime.
But you have admitted that you have broken our regulations controlling the sale of your metal.
I do not recognize your right to control the sale of my metal.
Is it necessary for me to point out that your recognition was not required?
No. I am fully aware of it, and I am acting accordingly.
He noted the stillness of the room. By the rules of the complicated pretense which all those people played for one another's benefit, they should have considered his stand as incomprehensible folly. There should have been rustles of astonishment and derision. There were none. They sat still.